watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Following the September 11th attacks, commentators remarked that Americans were experiencing for the first time what it was like to be targeted for who you are. African-American scholar and theologian Cornel West made the rejoinder that this was a new experience perhaps for white Americans, but not for black Americans. Most white people, even those who pride themselves on their lack of prejudice, are unaware how different their life experience is from that of black people, though we supposedly live in the same society. And that this difference is rooted in a history that has shaped the present in deep ways. Tonight, in commemoration of Black History Month, some perspectives on the American experience through the lens of race.
We soon will be riding my shiny black bears. No fat rich man's pony.
Though the struggle for justice for black Americans symbolized by the celebration of Martin Luther King's birthday has made changes in society that have allowed some to benefit and even to reach some of the highest offices in the land, African Americans as a whole suffer from more poverty, more imprisonment, more police violence, and poorer health. There are those among the white population who believe that a level playing field now exists and therefore this state of affairs must somehow be the fault of African Americans themselves. In America, there is a myth of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, and many white Americans believe they have done just that. Not exactly. Their parents possessed some modicum of financial security and were able to assist their children in various ways that contributed to their children's success. Psychologically, the parents were able to pass on to their children a vision of a somewhat reasonable world where the child could play by the rules and get rewarded based on her or his individual effort. This was the white parents' experience of the world, which they passed on as a legacy to their children, which they in turn received from their parents, and so on. I'd like to begin the program with the reading of an article that really drives this point home in a way that I think that many of us here, with our love of the land and strong connection to it, can understand. Last December, the Associated Press published a report based on an extensive investigation. It's titled, Torn from the Land, AP Documents Land Taken from Blacks Through Trickery, Violence, and Murder. It was written by Todd Lewin and Dolores Barclay, with contributions from Woody Baird, Alan G. Breed, Sheila Hardwell Bird, Alan Clendenning, Ron Harris, David Lieb, Bill Poovey, and investigative researcher Randy Hershaft. For generations, black families passed down the tales in uneasy whispers. They stole our land. These were family secrets shared after the children fell asleep, after the neighbors turned down the lamps, old stories locked in fear and shame. Some of those whispered bits of oral history, it turns out, are true. In an 18-month investigation, the Associated Press documented a pattern in which black Americans were cheated out of their land or driven from it through intimidation, violence, and even murder. In some cases, government officials approved the land takings, in others, they took part in them. The earliest occurred before the Civil War, others are being litigated today. Some of the land taken from black families has become a country club in Virginia, oil fields in Mississippi, a Major League Baseball spring training facility in Florida. The United States has a long history of bitter, often violent land disputes, from claim jumping in the gold fields to range wars in the Old West to broken treaties with American Indians. Poor white landowners, too, were sometimes treated unfairly, pressured to sell out at rock-bottom prices by railroads and lumber and mining companies. The fate of black landowners has been an overlooked part of this story. The AP, in an investigation that included interviews with more than 1,000 people and the examination of tens of thousands of public records in county courthouses and state and federal archives, documented 107 land takings in 13 southern and border states. In those cases alone, 406 black landowners lost more than 24,000 acres of farm and timberland, plus 85 smaller properties, including stores and city lots. Today, virtually all of this property, valued at tens of millions of dollars, is owned by whites or by corporations. Properties taken from blacks were often small, a 40-acre farm, a general store, a modest house. But the losses were devastating to families struggling to overcome the legacy of slavery. In the agrarian South, land ownership was the ladder to respect and prosperity, the means to building economic security and passing wealth on to the next generation. When black families lost their land, they lost all of this. "When they steal your land, they steal your future," said Stephanie Higgins, 40, of Atlanta, who has been researching how her great-grandmother, Abla Weddington Stewart, lost 35 acres in Matthews, North Carolina. A white lawyer foreclosed on Stewart in 1942 after he refused to allow her to finish paying off a $540 debt, witnesses told the AP. "How different would our lives be," Higgins asked, "if we'd had the opportunities, the pride, that land brings?" No one knows how many black families have been unfairly stripped of their land, but there are indications of extensive loss. Besides the 107 cases the AP documented, reporters found evidence of scores of other land takings that could not be fully verified because of gaps or inconsistencies in the public record. Thousands of additional reports of land takings from black families remain uninvestigated. 2,000 have been collected in recent years by the Penn Center on St. Helena Island, South Carolina, an educational institution established for freed slaves during the Civil War. The Land Loss Prevention Project, a group of lawyers in Durham, North Carolina, who represent blacks in land disputes, said it receives new reports daily. And Heather Gray of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives in Atlanta said her organization has file cabinets full of complaints. AP's findings are just the tip of one of the biggest crimes of this country's history, said Ray Winbush, director of Fisk University's Institute of Race Relations. Some examples of land takings documented by the AP. After midnight on October 4, 1908, 50 hooded white men surrounded the home of a black farmer in Hickman, Kentucky, and ordered him to come out for a whipping. When David Walker refused and shot at them instead, the mob poured coal oil on his house and set it afire, according to contemporary newspaper accounts. Pleading for mercy, Walker ran out the front door, followed by four screaming children and his wife, carrying a baby in her arms. The mob shot them all, wounding three children and killing the others. Walker's oldest son never escaped the burning house. No one was ever charged with the killings, and the surviving children were deprived of the farm their father had died defending. Land records show that Walker's 2.5-acre farm was simply folded into the property of a white neighbor. The neighbor soon sold it to another man, whose daughter owns the undeveloped land today. Another example. In the 1950s and 1960s, a Chevrolet dealer in Holmes County, Mississippi, acquired hundreds of acres from black farmers by foreclosing on small loans for farm equipment and pickup trucks. Norman Weathersby, then the only dealer in the area, required the farmers to put up their land as security for the loans, county residents who dealt with him said. And the equipment he sold them, they said, often broke down shortly thereafter. Weathersby's friend, William E. Strider, ran the local Farmers Home Administration, the credit lifeline for many Southern farmers. Area residents, including Irma Russell, 81, said Strider, now dead, was often slow in releasing farm operating loans to blacks. When cash-poor farmers missed payments owed to Weathersby, he took their land. The AP documented 8 cases in which Weathersby acquired black-owned farms this way. When he died in 1973, he left more than 700 acres of this land to his family, according to estate papers, deeds, and court records. And another example. In 1964, the state of Alabama sued Lemon Williams and Lawrence Hudson, claiming the cousins had no right to 2 40-acre farms their family had worked in Sweetwater, Alabama, for nearly a century. The land, officials contended, belonged to the state. Circuit Judge Emmett F. Hildreth urged the state to drop its suit, declaring it would result in a severe injustice. But when the state refused, saying it wanted income from timber on the land, the judge ruled against the family. Today, the land lies empty. The state recently opened some of it to logging. The state's internal memos and letters on the case are peppered with references to the family's race. In the same courthouse where the case was heard, the AP located deeds and tax records documenting that the family had owned the land since an ancestor bought the property on January 3, 1874. Surviving records also show the family paid property taxes on the farms from the mid-1950s until the land was taken. AP reporters tracked the land cases by reviewing deeds, mortgages, tax records, estate papers, court proceedings, surveyor maps, oil and gas leases, marriage records, census listings, birth records, death certificates, and Freedmen's Bureau archives. Additional documents, including FBI files and Farmers Home Administration records, were obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. The AP interviewed black families that lost land, as well as lawyers, title searchers, historians, appraisers, genealogists, surveyors, land activists, and local and state and federal officials. The AP also talked to current owners of the land, nearly all of whom acquired the properties years after the land takings occurred. Most said they knew little about the history of their land. When told about it, most expressed regret. Weathersby's son John, 62, who now runs the dealership in Indianola, Mississippi, said he had little direct knowledge about his father's business affairs. However, he said he was sure his father never would have sold defective vehicles and that he always treated people fairly. Alabama Governor Don Siegelman examined the state's files on the Sweetwater case after an inquiry from AP. He said he found them disturbing and has asked the state attorney general to review the matter. "What I have asked the attorney general to do," he said, "is look not only at the letter of the law, but at what is fair and right. The land takings are part of a larger picture, a 91-year decline in black land ownership in America." In 1910, black Americans owned more farmland than at any other time before or since, at least 15 million acres. Nearly all of it was in the South, largely in Mississippi, Alabama, and the Carolinas, according to the U.S. Agricultural Census. Today, blacks own only 1.1 million acres of the country's more than 1 billion acres of arable land. They are part owners of another 1.07 million acres. The number of white farmers has declined over the last century, too, as economic trends have concentrated land in fewer, often corporate hands. However, black ownership has declined 2.5 times faster than white ownership, the U.S. Civil Rights Commission noted in a 1982 report, the last comprehensive federal study on the trend. The decline in black land ownership has a number of causes, including the discriminatory lending practices of the Farmers Home Administration and the migration of blacks from the rural South to industrial centers in the North and West. However, the land takings also contributed. In the decades between Reconstruction and the Civil Rights Struggle, black families were powerless to prevent them, said Stuart E. Tolney, a University of Washington sociologist and co-author of a book on lynchings. In an era when black Americans could not drink from the same water fountains as whites, and black men were lynched for whistling at white women, few blacks dared to challenge whites. Those who did could rarely find lawyers to take their cases, or judges who would give them a fair hearing. The Reverend Isaac Simmons was an exception. When his land was taken, he found a lawyer and tried to fight back. In 1942, his 141-acre farm in Amity County, Mississippi, was sold for non-payment of taxes, property records show. The farm, for which his father had paid $302 in 1887, was bought by a white man for $180. Only partial tattered tax records for the period exist today in the county courthouse. But they are enough to show the tax payments on at least part of the property were current when the land was taken. Simmons hired a lawyer in February 1944 and filed suit to get his land back. On March 26th, a group of whites paid Simmons a visit. The minister's daughter, Laura Lee Houston, now 74, recently recalled her terror as she stood with her month-old baby in her arms and watched the men drag Simmons away. I screamed and hollered so loud, she said. They came toward me, and I ran down into the woods. The whites then grabbed Simmons' son Eldridge from his house and drove the two men to a lonely road. Two of them kept beating me, Eldridge Simmons later told the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. They kept telling me that my father and I were smart niggers for going to see a lawyer. Simmons, who has since died, said his captors gave him 10 days to leave town and told his father to start running. Later that day, the minister's body turned up with 3 gunshot wounds in the back, the Macomb Enterprise newspaper reported at that time. Today, the Simmons land, thick with timber and used for hunting, is privately owned and is assessed at $33,660. Officials assess property for tax purposes, and the valuation is usually less than its market value. Over the past 20 years, a handful of black families have sued to regain their ancestral lands. State courts, however, have dismissed their cases on the grounds that the statutes of limitations had expired. A group of attorneys led by Harvard University law professor Charles J. Ogletree has been making inquiries recently about land takings. The group has announced its intention to file a national class action lawsuit in pursuit of reparations for slavery and racial discrimination. However, some legal experts say redress for many land takings may not be possible unless laws are changed. As the acres slipped away, so did treasured pieces of family history, cabins crafted by a grandfather's hand, family graves in shaded groves. But the home place meant more than just that. Many blacks have found it very difficult to transfer wealth from one generation to the next because they had trouble holding on to land, said Paula Giddings, a history professor at Duke University. I'm reading from an article by the Associated Press, published in December 2001, Torn from the Land. And continuing. The Espy family in Vero Beach, Florida, lost its heritage in 1942 when the U.S. government seized its land through eminent domain to build an airfield. Government agencies frequently take land this way for public purposes under rules that require fair compensation for the owners. In Vero Beach, however, the Navy appraised the SB's 147 acres, which included a 30-acre fruit grove, two houses, and 40 house lots, at $8,000, according to the court records. The SB sued, and an all-white jury awarded them $13,000. That amounted to one-sixth of the price per acre that the Navy paid white neighbors for similar land with fewer improvements, records show. After World War II, the Navy gave the airfield to the city of Vero Beach. Ignoring the SB's plea to buy back their land, the city sold part of it at $1,500 an acre to the Los Angeles Dodgers in 1965 as a spring training facility. In 1999, the former Navy land with parts of Dodger Town and a municipal airport was assessed at $6.9 million. 60% of that land once belonged to the SB's. The team sold its property to Indian River County for $10 million in August, according to Craig Callan, a Dodgers official. The true extent of land takings from black families will never be known because of gaps in property and tax records in many rural southern counties. The AP found crumbling tax records, deed books with pages torn from them, file folders with documents missing, and records that had been crudely altered. In Jackson Parish, Louisiana, 40 years of moldy, gnawed tax and mortgage records were piled in a cellar behind a roll of Christmas lights and a wooden reindeer. In Yazoo County, Mississippi, volumes of tax and deed records filled a classroom in an abandoned school. The papers were coated with white dust from a falling ceiling. The AP retrieved dozens of documents that custodians said were earmarked for shredders or landfills. The AP also found that about a third of the county courthouses in southern and border states have burned, some more than once since the Civil War. Some of the fires were deliberately set. On the night of September 10, 1932, for example, 15 whites torched the courthouse in Paulding, Mississippi, where property records for the eastern half of Jasper County, then predominantly black, were stored. Records for the predominantly white western half of the county were safe in another courthouse miles away. The door to the Paulding courthouse's safe, which protected the records, had been locked the night before, the Jasper County News reported at the time. The next morning, the safe was found open, most of the records reduced to ashes. Suddenly, it was unclear who owned a big piece of eastern Jasper County. Even before the courthouse fire, land ownership in Jasper County was contentious. According to historical accounts, the Ku Klux Klan, resentful that blacks were buying and profiting from land, had been attacking black-owned farms, burning houses, lynching black farmers, and chasing black landowners away. The Masonite Corporation, a wood products company, was one of the largest landowners in the area. Because most of the land records had been destroyed, the company went to court in December 1937 to clear its title. Masonite believed it owned 9,581 acres, and said in court papers that it had been unable to locate anyone with a rival claim to the land. A month later, the court ruled the company had clear title to the land, which has since yielded millions of dollars in natural gas, timber, and oil, according to state records. From the few property records that remain, the AP was able to document that at least 204.5 of those acres had been acquired by Masonite after black owners were driven off by the Klan. At least 850,000 barrels of oil have been pumped from this property, according to State Oil and Gas Board records and figures from the Petroleum Technology Transfer Council, an industry group. Today, the land is owned by International Paper Corporation, which acquired Masonite in 1988. Jenny Boardman, a company spokeswoman, said International Paper has been unaware of the tragic history of the land and was concerned about AP's findings. This is probably part of a much larger public debate about whether there should be restitution for people who have been harmed in the past, she said. And by virtue of the fact that we now own these lands, we should be part of that discussion. Even when Southern Courthouse has remained standing, mistrust and fear of white authority long kept blacks away from record rooms, where documents were often segregated into white and colored. Many elderly blacks say they still remember how they were snubbed by court clerks, spat upon, and even struck. Today, however, fear and shame have given way to pride. Interest in genealogy among black families is surging, and some black Americans are unearthing the documents behind those whispered stories. People are out there wondering, whatever happened to Grandma's land? Said Loretta Carter Haynes, 75, a retired genealogist. They knew that their grandparents shed a lot of blood and tears to get it. Brian Logan, a 55-year-old sports writer from Washington, D.C., was researching his heritage when he uncovered a connection to 264 acres of riverfront property in Richmond, Virginia. Today, the land is Willow Oaks, an almost exclusively white country club, with an assessed value of $2.94 million. But in the 1850s, it was a corn and wheat plantation worked by the Howlett slaves, Logan's ancestors. Their owner, Thomas Howlett, directed in his will that his 15 slaves be freed, that his plantation be sold, and that the slaves receive the proceeds. When he died in 1856, his white relatives changed the will, but two courts upheld it. Yet the freed slaves never got a penny. Benjamin Hatcher, the executor of the estate, simply took over the plantation, court records show. He cleared the timber and mined the stone, providing granite for the Navy and War Department buildings in Washington and the Capitol in Richmond, according to records in the National Archives. When the Civil War ended in 1865, the former slaves complained to the occupying Union Army, which ordered Virginia courts to investigate. Hatcher testified that he had sold the plantation in 1862, apparently to his son Thomas, but had not given the proceeds to the former slaves. Instead, court papers show, the proceeds were invested on their behalf in Confederate war bonds. There is nothing in the public record to suggest the former slaves wanted their money used to support the Southern war effort. Moreover, the bonds were purchased in the former slaves' names in 1864, a dubious investment at best in the fourth year of the war. Within months, Union armies were marching on Atlanta and Richmond, and the bonds were worthless pieces of paper. The blacks insisted they were never given even that. But in 1871, Virginia's highest court ruled that Hatcher was innocent of wrongdoing and that the former slaves were owed nothing. The following year, the plantation was broken up and sold at a public auction. Hatcher's son received the proceeds, county records show. In the 1930s, a Richmond businessman cobbled the estate back together. He sold it to Willow Oaks Corporation in 1955 for an unspecified amount. I don't hold anything against Willow Oaks, Logan said. But how Virginia's courts acted, how they allowed the land to be stolen, it goes against everything America stands for. And that was Torn from the Land, AP Documents Land Taken from Blacks Through Trickery, Violence, and Murder, from December 2001. For links to more information about this story and investigation, check the Unwelcome Guest website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome.
Why shall I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved, just like a tree planted by the water. I shall not be moved.
I'm very honored this afternoon to come before you to present this very fine and distinguished gentleman that I'm about to introduce to you and that you will hear. His name is the Reverend Kenneth I. Clark, Sr., and he is the current director of Cornell United Religious Work. A native of Baltimore, Maryland, Reverend Clark earned a Bachelor's of Art degree in English from Morgan State University. He then received his Master of Divinity degree from Colgate Rochester Divinity School in Rochester, New York. He has worked with the Ethiopian Refugees Resettlement Project of the Third Baptist Church in San Francisco, California, and later served as assistant pastor and administrator.
Now, as you know, preachers have an occupational hazard, which is to speak too long. I will try to avoid that this afternoon in my relatively brief comments as I speak today about how Dr. King speaks to us in wartime. At this time in which the nation is engaged in war in Afghanistan, engaged in what has been called a long-term war on terrorism in response to the attacks of September 11, 2001, attacks which killed over 3,000 persons in New York, in Pennsylvania, and at the Pentagon. I thought it would be most instructive for us to consider what Martin Luther King Jr. says to us in wartime, as we consider the way in which he addressed the war in which this nation was involved in the last years of his life. I think that what Dr. King has to say to us about war can help us in the first instance to understand his mature and expanded dream for American society. The war Dr. King addressed was the war in Vietnam. For many of us in this room today, the Vietnam War is history. History studied in textbooks or documented on the History Channel. For others of us, particularly those of us 40 and older, it is not only history, it is part of our memory. We remember it as a war that divided the nation, with protests against the war in local communities and on college campuses such as Cornell and Ithaca College. We remember it as a war we saw on television every night. If we watched television at 6:30 in the evening, we saw the war reported on CBS, NBC, ABC. There were not a million cable, satellite, or digital channels to channel surf if we got bored with the evening news. The only option we had was to get up and turn the TV off. And we had to get up and turn off the TV because most of us did not have remote control. We remember it as a war that took many young men and women from our communities, many of whom did not return home. And for some of those who returned home, they did not return home in the same manner in which they left home. A point that was driven home in powerful terms in the 1970 song Edwin Starr sang called War, in which he talked about how the war had shattered many a young man's dreams, made them disabled, bitter, and mean. And we should know that the Vietnam conflict, for these reasons, was a war that Dr. King opposed. Dr. King opposed that war not solely because he was a proponent and was committed to a philosophy of nonviolence, but Dr. King stated clearly additional reasons for opposing the war, reasons that are articulated in perhaps his most famous anti-war address called A Time to Break Silence, a message that he delivered from the pulpit of the Riverside Church on April 4th, 1967 in New York City, exactly 1 year to the day he would be assassinated. King said that the war in Vietnam, 8,000 miles from these shores, was draining resources from the war on poverty in the United States, the anti-poverty programs initiated by President Johnson. Dr. King said that for a brief shining moment, there seemed to be an opportunity to really do something about poverty in American society. But the military buildup in Vietnam undermined the poverty program. Witnessing this diversion of priorities, Dr. King said, "I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor as long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled," he said, "to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such." Dr. King also opposed the war because he saw a disproportionate number of black and Latino men compared to their numbers in the general U.S. population being drafted into military service as frontline warriors. Grunts, they were called. In his own words, he saw, and I quote, "black young men who had been crippled by our society, sent 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia or East Harlem." He watched on television black and white soldiers in what he called brutal solidarity burn the huts of a poor village. Men and women, black men, white men, who would not, he said, have lived on the same block in Detroit. Dr. King regarded this war as a brutal manipulation of the poor, and thus he could not support it. Thirdly, Dr. King opposed the war because he had lived, as many of us old enough to remember, had also lived through, the long, hot summers of the 1960s, when riots erupted in major urban centers of the United States. Having spent much time in these cities, he said that riots were the language of the unheard. At the same time, he tried to persuade those who rioted out of desperation, out of want, out of anger with their social conditions, to put down their Molotov cocktails and their rifles. But they said to him, "What, Dr. King, what about Nam, the shorthand for Vietnam at that time? Isn't America using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about change? Are we no different than what our government is doing?" And so in his own words, Dr. King said, and I quote again, "I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without first having spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of these boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I could not be silent." From these statements, we get glimpses of the matured dream of Martin Luther King Jr. His dream had expanded beyond the one he articulated with everlasting eloquence on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial on August 28, 1963, a day I remember vividly as a six-year-old in Baltimore waiting for my mother, who was a labor union participant with the International League of Women Garment Workers, participating in that march, waiting for her on that brutally hot August Wednesday for her to come home. I recall that march, as do many of you yet alive to have witnessed it or to experienced it. On that day in August 1963, Dr. King articulated a dream of an integrated society based on the assumptions of liberal integrationism, which assumed that with some tweaking here and there, some social engineering here and there, that an essentially good society could be reformed. That with the placement of high-profile persons of colors here and there integrating the system, what Manning Marable has called symbolic representation, all persons of color would be lifted up by the rising tide of progress. King's dream of 1963 assumed, for example, that gaining the right to vote in the segregated South would eradicate the last great barrier to black freedom. But King came to a realization. It was after the riots in Watts in South Central Los Angeles in August 1965. 6 days after the signing into law of the Federal Historic Voting Rights Act. He came to a realization as he talked to Bayard Rustin, the logistical genius of the March on Washington, when he said to him, you know, for 10 long years, I have worked to gain the right for black folks to sit down at the lunch counter next to whites. Now I must work to make sure they have the economic means to buy the lunch. And so as King's dream begins to evolve beyond just integrationism, and it was important to articulate the vision and the importance as it is today of a multicultural society, King's vision began to move toward the need to build a multicultural democracy. And in order to build that type of multicultural democracy, economic justice had to be at the forefront of that agenda. And that would not call for reform. That would call for what Dr. King called a revolution of values in American society. It would call for a restructuring of the economic system to allow for full employment. It would call for a significant infusion of funds to eliminate poverty, to get rid of ghettos and slums. It would call for a reinvigoration of the public education system, which even then, before the woes that we complain about and struggle with in Ithaca and other places, public education was then on the decline. It was then when Dr. King began to talk about the need for full universal health insurance back in 1967. We recall just 8 years ago when the Clinton administration put forth a proposal for full universal health care insurance, how that was shot to shreds in the Congress. But in 1967, King began to talk about the need for full universal health insurance. He understood and believed that a nation with so much resources, the richest nation on earth, somehow had to find a way to create an equitable playing ground for everyone. We find these proposals that King laid out in his last book, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community? Particularly, the piece of interest is the adaptation of A. Philip Randolph's Freedom Budget for All Americans. A. Philip Randolph was the great labor leader, one of the greatest labor leaders of the 20th century. And he adopted his proposal for a freedom budget for all Americans, which included the need to address these issues. How does this speak to us today? As we live through this war, and the response of our nation to the horrors that took place on the 11th of September 2001, we must understand, as King understood, the manner in which our own society has continued that legacy of being the purveyor of violence. That while on the one hand there needs to be, in my view, a military response to what happened to us, on the other hand, the question is whether the objectives or the manner in which this so-called long-term war on terrorism are really the way in which we should address the problem. It's one thing to go after the perpetrators of the attacks of September 11th. It's another thing to ignore the conditions that give rise to terrorism. I think that if we really want to, from my layperson's point of view, if you will, end terrorism, we need to end the despair that leads to terrorism. We need to get rid of the poverty that makes men and women feel that they must distort a great religion in order to achieve their means, in order to be heard. We must address the imbalances and the inequalities of rich and poor in the Western Hemisphere vis-a-vis the rest of the world. We must address the issues that give rise to terrorism and not just address the response of those who engage in terrorism. Dr. King told us that peace is not the absence of tension, but it is the presence of justice. We must find a way, with all of the resources, with all of the economic might and power that we have, to bring that justice about in other parts of the world. That injustice that has been created by decades of wrong-headed foreign policy. Secondly, Dr. King would remind us today that what we must also do is that while we look at and we recall and we recoil at the horrors of September 11th, we must also recognize that there are also other types of terrorism that take place in our own communities. There is the terrorism of violence, of crime. There is the terrorism of unequal, inadequately funded public schools. There is the terrorism that is perpetrated in which we find disproportionate numbers of African American males in special education at the high school level. Disproportionate numbers of African American and Latino males in prison compared to their numbers in the general population. We must address other types of terrorism that take place on our own soil, far less dramatic than what took place on September 11th, but equally as devastating to the communities that are affected. I watched as the Congress galvanized itself and put forth millions of dollars to support the military effort that we are engaged in now, and I thought to myself, it seems to me, if we can galvanize that kind of effort to take military action, billions of dollars that we cannot even count, if we can put together a Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe after the devastation of World War II, if we could put in place democratic reforms in Japan under the leadership of Douglas MacArthur after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, if we could galvanize ourselves and use millions of dollars to bail out corporations like Chrysler in the 70s, if we could bail out the savings and loan industry after the scandals of the 80s, it seems to me that we can invest millions of dollars in a Marshall Plan to invest in people and save our communities. That's what King was calling for with that freedom budget for all Americans. He was calling for a reinvestment into the community because, as he said in that Riverside speech, a nation that spends millions of dollars year after year on military programs instead of programs of social uplift is a nation approaching spiritual death. And if we want to overcome death, we must invest in life. We must invest in that which gives life. We must invest in that that empowers life. We must invest in that that empowers people. If we are indeed to grasp what Dr. King says to us in wartime, the last thing I want to say to you this afternoon is this. Dr. King, when he spoke out against the war, he said very clearly that speaking out against the war did not render him as an unpatriotic citizen. He says in that Riverside speech that he was deeply disappointed with America's involvement in the war and the way in which that war had undermined the war and poverty. But he said there cannot be great disappointment where there is not great love. He said he loved America. But he could not stand idly by while America engaged in this war. A war not only against the Vietnamese, but a war against the poor in this society. I want to say during this time in which there have been crackdowns on civil liberties, when we have people being interred because of their appearance as persons of Middle Eastern descent oftentimes, as we fear reprisal for speaking out, when there are those even within the government of the United States that would assume that to speak out against this war is to be unpatriotic, I say to you this afternoon, it is not unpatriotic to speak your peace against the war. Dr. King articulated this in 1968 in the last speech of his life, April 3rd, 1968, at Mason Temple in Memphis, Tennessee, where he said, somewhere I read about the right to dissent. Somewhere I read about the right to protest. Somewhere I read about an amendment that ensures me the freedom to speak my mind against the issues of the day. Somewhere I read about the right to be able to dissent in order to make the country better. We who are concerned about the prosecution of this war, we who are concerned about the erosion of civil liberties, we who are concerned about what this means for us in the society, have the right to exercise our citizenship and to speak our minds. For in doing so, we exercise the right, we demonstrate what it means to live in a democratic society. And in doing so, we lend our voice to a broader national conversation. For in doing so, we seek not to tear down the nation, but to make it better. By doing so, we seek to get to the root causes of what led to the horrors of September 11th. By doing so, we are able, as Dr. King, to be able to see in a full perspective how war abroad affects our ability to address social problems at home. And in doing so, we are able to live holistically. We are able to live lives that are not compartmentalized. I would submit to you today that one of the reasons why we continue to have the race problem that Dr. King fought against and gave his life for is because there has been a separation, there has been a dichotomization that allows us to objectify other persons based on their race as opposed to a holistic understanding of who people are and that who all of us are as persons with God-given rights. So I would submit to you in the final analysis, my friends, our need to look at what Dr. King speaks of and how he speaks to us in wartime. And in looking at how Dr. King speaks to us in wartime, to embrace his more expansive vision for the society. A vision for the society that calls for us to be able to live as a truly multicultural democracy where economic justice exists, where every child has an opportunity to go to school is able to go to a school fully equipped with all the resources he or she needs. To envision a society where everyone has adequate health care. To envision a society in which every person can live free of want, free of poverty, free of racism. And in that, and as we work toward those goals, then we pursue the beloved community that King articulated in his vision, and a community that is built on the principles of justice, that is motivated by love, that enables us to create a multicultural democracy. Thank you.
That was Reverend Kenneth I. Clark, Sr., Director of Cornell United Religious Works, speaking at the Greater Ithaca Activities Center on Martin Luther King's birthday. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. Following Clark's presentation, an elder speak-out was held. One of the speakers was an educational consultant, Jackie Melton Scott, who gave a pointed assessment on what yet needs to be accomplished in the Ithaca community.